Thank you, Rena. I want to reinforce the welcome to all of you to this session, and especially thank the Student Legal Forum, which has sponsored this event for a number of years. I haven't counted them, but it's become a kind of standing tradition that really helps mark the opening of the school year. So thank you for making it possible. As you know, we'll talk about the 2009-2010 term of Supreme Court. We make no effort to be comprehensive, obviously, in the time we've got, so it'll be a few selected cases that we hope will throw some light on the court. And rather than having a Q&A session at the end, our plan, there'll be a reception, I understand, Rena, and I'm sure the members of the panel would be happy to linger for a few minutes and take questions from any of you who might want to hang around. What I'd like to do is to try to throw a little perspective on the term by making remarks about the Roberts Court at age five. If this were a session in child psychology, it would be kind of fascinating to consult what textbooks have to say about the behavior of five-year-olds, but I think Chief Justice John Roberts would not be grateful if I did that. But I think to understand the court as it is now, as it has been this past term, one has to think about the struggle that's been ongoing, going all the way back to 1969, between successive Republican presidents and their effort to, in effect, remake the face of the Supreme Court, starting with Richard Nixon and his disapproval of the Warren Court, and then Reagan and his unhappiness with the Burger Court, reaching right on down through the two presidents Bush. And starting with Nixon, you began to have, one after another, the addition to the court of conservative justices who, first you had Rehnquist, the lone dissenter, but then gradually others were added, like Scalia and then Thomas, to the point where you began to have something like, if not a working majority, at least an important conservative bloc. 2005, exactly 5 years ago, the beginning of the Roberts Court, you may remember that remarkable summer when Sandra Day O'Connor resigned from the court. President Bush nominated John Roberts to take her seat. Then unexpectedly, Chief Justice Rehnquist died, and Bush then moved Roberts over to the Chief Justice's seat, and finally O'Connor's seat was filled by Samuel Alito. So by 2006, you had the makings of the Roberts Court. But that particular term, I think, is not one that turns out to be very helpful in assessing what this court has come to look like, because Alito really didn't join its ranks until January of 2006. It was the following term, 2006-2007, that you began to see emerging something like a Roberts Court, a more conservative court, and we began to see the impact of Justice Alito taking the place of Sandra Day O'Connor. I mean, that term, for example, saw an important abortion decision when the court upheld the federal Partial Birth Abortion Act. It saw a case having to do with race in schools where the court said in cases from Seattle and Louisville that you could not take race into account in assigning students. An important church and state case when the court said taxpayers have no standing to challenge White House initiatives and so forth. And you began to see a distinctively conservative cast to the court's opinions. The term after that, 2007-2008, once again, ideological splits, I think, were fairly obvious. That was a big term. You had the Second Amendment case, D.C. versus Heller, Guantanamo detainee case, a case involving capital punishment for defendants who raped children. And it was interesting that though the ideological splits were obvious, that the more conservative bloc didn't win all those cases. For example, though they clearly won D.C. versus Heller, 5-4, the case involving the death penalty for rape of children was a victory for the more liberal bloc on the vote, bloc on the court. And it was a term in which, once again, we began to see why Kennedy had swung into the position of occupying the fifth seat that used to be that of O'Connor. The term before this last one, 2008-2009, was somewhat peculiar. I mean, it began to sort of mystify court watchers because some commentators began to talk about it as a term of incrementalism or minimalism. It looked like you had two pairs, Thomas and Scalia, and then you had Alito and Roberts, who were moving in the same direction but at a different pace. And the term ended with fairly important cases that sort of fizzled. The New Haven firefighters case, for example, was one where it was thought that the court might use that case to cut back on the reach of the 14th Amendment. They did not. There was a Voting Rights Act case where people were expecting that the court might use that case to maybe trim a bit the reach of the 15th Amendment. The court did not. It stopped short of constitutional holdings in both of those cases. A number of theories abounded, as they often do. One theory was that the conservatives on the court had to be somewhat restrained in order to get Kennedy the fifth vote in those cases. There was the theory that perhaps Chief Justice Roberts was concerned about the institutional image of the court and was concerned lest the court look to be somehow judicially activist. But there was also a theory that the conservatives were simply willing to bide their time, that they, being the younger justices by and large, they didn't have to do everything overnight, that they could wait and the destination would be reached in due course. Now, the term that's just ended, the 2009-2010 term, is one in which I think in good part, not completely, but in good part, it sort of justifies the conventional view of the court as being four conservatives, four moderate liberals, and then Justice Kennedy in the middle, because there were big cases this past term decided along what I would call ideological lines by 5-4 vote. Citizens United foremost among those, which Leslie Kendrick will be talking about this afternoon. McDonald versus City of Chicago, that was a follow-up to the Heller case, a Second Amendment case, again a 5-4 decision. Purdue versus Kennedy, that's a case that limited the ability of civil rights attorneys to receive enhanced fee awards in cases where they achieve great success. And another example, Hollingsworth versus Perry, a summary order of the court got some attention because the court blocked the experimental televising of a district court proceeding in California involving Proposition 8, the gay marriage California amendment. So in all those cases, you could see configurations in which the court appeared to be dividing along ideological lines. However, I would add that if one then surveyed the court more, the term more generally, I think the record would be a bit more mixed than that easy categorization might suggest. There was, for example, a case, United States versus Comstock, which was a case in which the court upheld Congress's power to provide for civil commitment of sexually dangerous persons who had completed their criminal sentence. And the court not only split in that case, it kind of was all over the map, and it's very hard to use that case to talk about easy categorizations. Nevertheless, law professors love to make easy categorizations. That's what I'm here for. So let me suggest several general propositions about the Roberts Court at age 5, not necessarily a misfit misbehaving badly, as 5-year-olds sometimes do, but what can we say about the court at the end of its fifth year? Well, first, I think it is fair to say there's been a distinct shift to the right. It's not been a monolithic, it's somewhat ad hoc, but it's surely clear that Alito taking the place of O'Connor matters, that has been had its impact. One study showed that there have been 44 justices on the court since 1937, and of the 6 most conservative justices by that measure, of those 44, 4 of those 6 are still on the court right now, and that is Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas. So if that study is to be believed, I think that's an interesting proposition. The shift to the right, as I say, is somewhat episodic, but I think it's pronounced all the same. Notwithstanding there being some liberal results, I mentioned the case about death penalty for the rape of a child. There have been some others. Second proposition I would advance is that there is in today's Supreme Court, a strong correlation between the political party of the appointing president and the ideological direction of a particular justice's decisions. Now, it used to be thought the court was full of surprises. Harry Blackmun, who moved sharply to the left, Justice John Paul Stevens, Sir David Souter, the so-called stealth candidate back from the 1990s. None of those justices is on the present court. They're all gone. And I think the fact is now we're not going to see surprises. I think the behavior by and large of the present court is going to be much more predictable than had been the case in the past. And I would say what we're seeing is the fruits of a conservative agenda that started very much in the Reagan administration with the Reagan Justice Department, for which, by the way, Roberts and Alito worked as young lawyers. My third proposition would be about aggressiveness or assertiveness. It seems to me that however you may define judicial activism or judicial restraint, that if you define it, let's say, by lack of deference to the political process or lack of concern or respect for precedent, if those are measures of judicial activism, this is an activist court. We associate activism with liberalism because back in the Warren and Berger days, it was the liberal justices who, by and large, were doing the overruling or the overturning. But now that conservatives are more nearly in control, they're the ones who are using the same techniques. If the 2008-2009 term, the one a year ago, ended on a note of judicial restraint or minimalism, whatever it might have been, it seems to me that you would not describe the term just ended as a term of judicial minimalism. Citizens United, for example, again, Professor Kendrick will talk about that. Surely the most controversial decision out of the Supreme Court since Bush versus Gore in the year 2000. And we'll see what Leslie Kendrick has to say about that, but I would say it does not look to me like a case where you would find traces of judicial minimalism. It's interesting also that the court during this term showed less deference to federal district courts. There's been a tradition that federal district courts in areas of district court discretion pretty much are not going to be overturned by the Supreme Court. There were some interesting exceptions to that this term, and I mentioned the televising of civil trials in California. That struck me as a case where it seemed a little unusual that the court would step in as summarily as it did and overturn that particular experiment. My fourth observation is about Chief Justice Roberts. I think it is fair to say that it is increasingly becoming the Roberts Court in every sense of the word. In the most recent term, Chief Justice Roberts was in the majority 92% of the time. That's more than any other one justice. The term before that, it had been Justice Kennedy, who was most often in the majority. So I think Roberts is, in some fashion or another, more nearly making it his court. My fifth observation is about Justice Kennedy. He's in the catbird seat, as we always know. It's nothing like being the fifth and critical vote in so many cases. He has obviously taken on the role that O'Connor used to play, but he is also manifestly more conservative than she became in her later years on the court. For example, there was an abortion case in the year 2000 where the court struck down a Nebraska statute banning partial birth abortion. And then in 2007, the court upheld a federal law, which I frankly find it hard to distinguish from the Nebraska statute of 2000. One other example in the racial area, in 2003, it was O'Connor who wrote the majority opinion in the Grutter case, the Michigan affirmative action case. And then 4 years later, the court, 5-4 in the Seattle and Louisville school cases, seemed to be taking a harder line against affirmative action. Kennedy is therefore critical, but he does tend to restrain the conservative impulse. For example, in the Seattle and Louisville cases, he wrote a separate concurring opinion saying, unlike Roberts, who wrote the court's opinion, that it wasn't necessarily always going to be true that race could not be used in cases like the one at bar. My sixth proposition is about the court's left. But you have to understand the left on the present court is not Warren court-style liberalism. These are moderate liberals by comparison. But the changes on the court, Sotomayor replacing Souter, really has done nothing to alter the court's ideological balance. Souter in this last term voted with Ginsburg and Breyer in 90% of the cases, so she's fallen pretty much into that block. And I would be very surprised if the replacement of Justice Stevens by Justice Kagan this coming term will make much difference either. What I think has changed It's interesting the leadership role that John Paul Stevens took on after all those years of being the wild card on the court. He really, in many ways, had become the intellectual or emotional leader of the more liberal justices. Seventh proposition, the court's right. Very interesting, the conservative behavior on the court. I would say Scalia and Thomas are, by my measure, activists. They are certainly willing to invalidate legislation or overturn precedent, and particularly Thomas. There are not many propositions around that Thomas doesn't like that he's not willing to overturn. And in this past term, I counted six or eight different cases in which he pointed out some rule that he didn't like and he was prepared to do away with it. It's interesting that these two justices do, by and large, read the Constitution in a narrow way that favors government power, but they have an interesting, what I would say was a principled approach to reading the Constitution, which sometimes will lead to what a commentator might call a liberal result, for example, in confrontation cases or sentencing cases. Alito, in some respects, I think, has become the court's most conservative justice. I'm not sure that's the conventional wisdom among commentators, but if by conservatism you mean what appears to be a confidence in government and a willingness to read the Constitution fairly narrowly, it seems to me he is pretty conservative. For example, there was a case this term, the Stevens case, involving a statute that criminalized video depictions of animal cruelty, in which he was the only dissenter. Final proposition, number eight, is sort of where we go from here. I think we're in for a somewhat unsettling ride for the next two or three terms. I think it's going to be difficult for me to stand up here and make the kinds of sweeping generalizations I have just done. Of course, these generalizations have to be qualified in any event, because any one term may not be a fair measure of the court's general posture. It depends on the cases that are on the docket. Like this most recent term, there were not abortion or church and state cases, on the merits at least, and so important area, some of the hot button issues were not there. But quite apart from the mix of cases, what interests me is the dynamic of personalities. I mean, you can't imagine nine justices who act without regard for each other. They are a small body, a fairly collegial body, I think that's fair to say, about the Roberts Court. And as any student of small group dynamics or behavior would I think, say, the dynamics matter. And so the court from, 1994 to 2005 had no vacancies. So the Rehnquist Court settled into a period of relative stability. Now it's been succeeded by those two vacancies in 2005, and then one more vacancy already. That's three new justices in about 5 years. And, of course, we'll have Justice Kagan on the bench this coming year. And I think all that will mean that it will take some time for the patterns to really begin to become clear. Finally, once that happens, I think we're in for a long ride. Chief Justice Roberts is a young guy. He's in his 50s. I think the prospect of much more turnover in the immediate future is not very great. So Roberts could be around for decades, and therefore so might the Roberts Court. Well, that's the long haul, but that's not what we're really here to talk about today. So without more comments about the term itself or the Roberts Court, let me pass the baton to Barbara Armacost for the criminal justice cases.
So I'm going to talk about two of the Supreme Court's criminal procedure cases. They're very different. The first case is Burgess versus Tompkins. That case is about the regulation of police interrogation under the Fifth Amendment. In Burgess, the Roberts Court has followed the Rehnquist Court in making it easier for police to obtain and use confessions. The second case is Graham versus Florida. It's an Eighth Amendment case in which the Supreme Court considered whether it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment to sentence a juvenile to life in prison without parole for a non-homicide offense. So let me begin with Burgess versus Thompson. or Tompkins. In order for you to understand how this case fits with the court's Fifth Amendment jurisprudence, I need to first give you some background about the court's Miranda cases. So in Miranda, the Supreme Court held that police officers have to inform suspects of their Fifth Amendment rights before they're questioned. The warnings are very familiar. There are four of them. You have a right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to an attorney, and if you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed for you. Now, the Supreme Court has held that unless a suspect has been given those warnings, understands them, and agrees to talk without an attorney, any confession that follows will be per se inadmissible against the suspect. Now, after Miranda, the Supreme Court handed down a series of cases that created a kind of timeline for dealing with Miranda issues. So imagine a suspect's brought in for questioning and police give the suspect their Miranda warnings. At this point, the suspect has two choices. He can waive his rights and agree to talk to the police without an attorney, or he can decide to invoke his rights and refuse to talk until he consults with a lawyer. Now, there are two crucial questions in connection with that timeline. The first question is, what will it take for the suspect to be deemed to have waived his Miranda rights? Does it require that the suspect sign something? Can the suspect verbally agree? Or what if the suspect just nods his head? Or suppose he doesn't say anything and he just starts to talk? The second question is, what will it take for the suspect to invoke his rights? So is simply refusing to answer enough? Does the suspect have to say, "I invoke"? What if the suspect says something ambiguous like, "Gee, maybe I ought to talk to a lawyer"? Do police have to clarify, or can they just keep asking questions? Now, on the question of waiver, the Miranda Court has said that the government has to overcome a heavy burden of proof to show that the waiver was voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. The Supreme Court specifically said that a suspect who simply remained silent after the warnings or simply began answering questions would not be deemed to waive his rights. The suspect had to give some affirmative indication that he understood his rights and was agreeing to answer. Now, the question of what constitutes a waiver is crucial. If a suspect is either not given warnings or the suspect is given warnings but does not waive, any statements that he makes are automatically inadmissible. On the question of invocation, the Supreme Court has held that if a suspect says he doesn't want to talk, police have to stop questioning him and leave him alone for some reasonable amount of time. If the suspect says he wants an attorney, he has even greater protection from police questioning. In a 1981 case called Edwards versus Arizona, the court held that once the suspect has asked for an attorney, police have to stop interrogating him and leave him alone. They can't resume questioning unless the suspect initiates some contact with the police. Now, if we go back to our timeline, we can see that invocation creates a kind of safe harbor for the suspect. So invocation of the right to remain silent creates only a temporary safe harbor. Police have to immediately stop their questioning, they have to leave the suspect alone for a little while, and then they can come back and resume. But once a suspect has said he wants an attorney, he enters an even safer place from which he's safe from any pressure to answer questions. In other words, police have to actually leave the suspect alone until the suspect consults a lawyer or comes forward again and says he's ready to talk. Now, the invocation safe harbor, I'm calling it, is the heart of the Miranda protection. If police can badger suspects into waiving after they've invoked their rights, then the right to silence and an attorney means nothing. But in order for the safe harbor to actually be protective, two things have to be true. First of all, it has to be easy to get into the safe harbor. And second of all, it has to be hard to get out. In other words, it has to be easy for the suspect to show that he invoked and hard for the government to show that the suspect has reinitiated and waived. Now, up to this point in time, most of the litigation about the Miranda safe harbor has involved the invocation of the right to an attorney. In the 80s and 90s, the Rehnquist Court slowly chipped away at the Edwards safe harbor by making it hard to get in and easy to get out. On the one hand, the Supreme Court made it hard for suspects to get into the safe harbor by holding that an invocation of the right to an attorney had to be clear and unambiguous. If it was not clear and unambiguous, police could simply ignore it and keep asking questions. Just to give you an understanding or some understanding of what the Supreme Court meant by unambiguous, the court held that the statement, quote, maybe I should talk to a lawyer, end quote, was not definitive enough to be an invocation. On the other hand, the Rehnquist court made it easy to get out of the safe harbor by holding that if the suspect initiates virtually any conversation with police, they can obtain a new waiver and start questioning again. Now, in three different Miranda cases this term, the Roberts Court has continued this trend of chipping away at that safe harbor, and the most important of the three is Burgess versus Tompkins. In Burgess, Mr. Tompkins was arrested in connection with a shooting that left a man dead from gunshot wounds. After his arrest, Tompkins was arrested and interrogated by two police officers. Before questioning him, the officers presented him with a piece of paper on which were written the Miranda warnings. The officers asked Thompson to read one section of the warning just to make sure that he could read and could speak English, and then the officer read all four of the Miranda warnings out loud and asked Tompkins to sign the form. Tompkins explicitly refused to sign. The officers then began to question Tompkins. The questioning lasted for 3 hours. At no point during the interrogation did Tompkins say either, I do want to talk, or I don't want to talk. He also didn't say, I do want an attorney, or I don't want an attorney. He didn't say anything. He just sat there and refused to answer any questions. Most of the time he sat with his head in his hands and was completely silent. One or two times he said yes or no, or I don't know, in response to a particular question, but most of the time he just sat there. Now, about 2 hours and 45 minutes into the interrogation, the police officer finally looked at Tompkins in exasperation and said, do you believe in God? And Tompkins said, kind of tearfully, yes. And the cop then said, do you pray to God to forgive you for shooting that boy down? And Tompkins answered, yes, incriminating himself in the shooting. Based on this statement and other evidence, Tompkins was then charged with first-degree murder, and he moved to suppress the statement that he made to the police. He argued that he never waived his Miranda rights before or during the interrogation, and that he invoked his right to remain silent by remaining silent and refusing to answer the officer's questions. He claimed that by continuing to badger him and question him, the police did not honor his invocation in violation of his Miranda rights. In a 5-4 decision, Justice Kennedy wrote for the court that Tompkins waived his rights and never invoked them. The court held that invocation requires something more affirmative than simply remaining silent, preferably that the suspect says, I want to remain silent. As Justice Sotomayor pointed out in her dissent, it's a bit ironic to require the suspect to say something in order to invoke his right not to say anything. The majority then went on to hold that Tompkins waived his right to remain silent because he was given his Miranda warnings, knew he could refuse to talk, and talked anyway. In other words, the majority did not require any affirmative indication that Tompkins understood his rights and wanted to talk without an attorney. The only affirmative indication necessary was that Thompson eventually talked. Ironically, these twin holdings mean that invocation requires something affirmative, but waiver does not. Now, the court's opinion in Burgess is a virtual rewriting of Miranda. The cases following Miranda had held that waivers could be implied based on the suspect's course of conduct. But the court had never disavowed Miranda's clear statement that, quote, waiver will not be presumed simply from the silence of the accused or simply from the fact that a confession was in fact eventually obtained, end quote. In fact, this is precisely what Burgess holds, that waiver may be implied by the mere fact that the suspect answered the interrogator's questions. In other words, waiver of Miranda rights need not be obtained before interrogation begins. Successful interrogation will constitute waiver. The most revealing part of the opinion is a paragraph near the end in which Justice Kennedy writes for himself, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. And here's what he says. Quote, interrogation provides the suspect with additional information that can put his or her decision to waive or not to invoke into perspective. As questioning commences and then continues, the suspect has the opportunity to consider the choices he or she faces and to make a more informed decision, either to insist on silence or to cooperate. Cooperation with the police may result in more favorable treatment for the suspect, apprehension of accomplices, the prevention of continuing injury or fear, beginning steps toward relief or solace for victims, and the beginning of the suspect's own return to the law and the social order it seeks to protect," end quote. What these statements reveal is a fundamental disagreement on the Supreme Court between those who believe that suspects should be encouraged to confess and those who believe that a suspect has an absolute right not to talk and that a criminal justice system that relies solely on confessions is a flawed system. The latter position is the one that was embraced by retired Justice Stevens and is reflected in Justice Sotomayor's dissent in Burgess. Here's what she writes, quote, "The underlying constitutional guarantee against self-incrimination reflects many of our fundamental values and most noble aspirations, including a fear that self-incrimination statements will be elicited by inhumane treatment and abuses, and a resulting distrust of self-incriminating statements, and a realization that while the privilege is sometimes a shelter to the guilty, it is often a protection to the innocent. For these reasons, we have observed, a criminal law system which comes to depend on the confession will, in the long run, be less reliable and more subject to abuses than a system relying on independent investigation," end quote. Okay, I want to talk for just a few minutes now about a second case, Graham versus Florida, in which the court held that a state may not sentence a juvenile offender to life in prison without parole for a crime not involving death. The defendant in the case was Terrence Graham. At age 16, Graham and three other school-aged youths attempted to rob a restaurant in Jacksonville, Florida. During the robbery, one of Graham's accomplices hit the restaurant owner twice with a lead pipe. Graham was charged as an adult for armed robbery with battery, a first-degree felony carrying a maximum penalty of life in prison without parole. Graham pleaded guilty to the charges, and at his plea hearing, he claimed that he intended to turn his life around. He was sentenced to 3 years probation with 1 year to be served in the county jail. Only 6 months after his release for this crime, though, Graham and two accomplices broke into a home, held the homeowner at gunpoint, and ransacked the house looking for money. Graham was arrested later that evening after attempting a second robbery. Graham's actions were a violation of his parole for the earlier crime. The minimum sentence Graham could have received in his current situation was 5 years, and the maximum was life in prison. At sentencing, the judge told Graham that he'd been given a chance and had blown it. The judge concluded there was nothing more he could do for Graham, and thus his priority was to protect the community from Graham's harmful actions. He sentenced Graham to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court held that Graham, who was just shy of his 18th birthday when he was arrested, could not be sentenced to life in prison without parole for a crime not involving death. The opinion was written by Justice Kennedy and joined by Justice Stevens, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. Chief Justice Roberts wrote a separate opinion concurring in the judgment. Justices Thomas, Scalia, and Alito dissented. The opinion in Graham versus Florida relied on the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. The court's Eighth Amendment jurisprudence begins with the precept that punishment for crime has to be graduated and proportioned to the offense. Under this notion of proportionality, the court has engaged in two kinds of Eighth Amendment review. In the first kind of review, which could be called proportionality review, the court considers whether a particular sentence, given all the circumstances of the crime, is proportional to the defendant's conduct. This kind of review is very limited, requiring intervention only if the sentence is grossly out of proportion. In the second kind of review, which could be called categorical review, the Supreme Court has exempted entire categories of defendants from punishment. Categorical review has been wholly limited to death penalty cases. In this line of cases, the Supreme Court has held that because death is different from any other kind of penalty, certain types of defendants should be exempt from sentences of death. In particular, the court has held that it would violate the Eighth Amendment to impose death on defendants who are mentally ill, defendants who are mentally retarded, defendants who are under the age of 18 at the time they committed their crimes, and defendants who have committed crimes in which the victim's life was not taken. Beginning in the Rehnquist era, this line of cases had been decided by very slim 5-member majorities of the court. In addition, the last of this line, Kennedy versus Louisiana, was decided by the Roberts Court prior to Justice Stevens' retirement. The four justices in dissent in Kennedy versus Louisiana were Justice Scalia, Alito, Thomas, and Roberts. Now, Graham versus Florida is a groundbreaking case for a number of reasons, the first of which is it's the first time in which the Supreme Court has excluded an entire class of offenders from a given form of punishment outside of the death penalty. In other words, it combines the two separate lines of Eighth Amendment review I just described. As I said a few minutes ago, categorical review was reserved for cases involving the death penalty on the ground that death is a very unusual and special kind of punishment. In Graham, however, the majority held that an entire category of defendants, in this case juveniles, are exempt not from the death penalty, but for a life sentence without parole. Graham marks the first time in which the Supreme Court has applied that kind of categorical review outside the death penalty. As Justice Thomas complained in his dissent, I guess death is no longer different. Graham versus Florida is also important because it disaggregates two kinds of arguments that have always occurred together. So prior Eighth Amendment cases involving juvenile offenders were premised on two lines of argument. The first is the now familiar claim that death is different. The second line of reasoning is that not only is death different, but juvenile offenders are different. In particular, they are less culpable than adult offenders. As the Supreme Court explained in Roper, the case that struck down the juvenile death penalty, there are three key differences between child offenders and adult offenders. First, children lack maturity and judgment. Second, children are more susceptible to pressures from the outside. Third, personality traits of children are not yet fixed. If you add those three points together, the Roper Court reasoned that children who commit crimes are less culpable and more subject to rehabilitation than their adult counterparts. In Graham, the Supreme Court disaggregated these two arguments, reasoning that because juveniles are different, they must also be treated differently in connection with sentences other than the death penalty. The five-justice majority in Graham adopted a categorical rule that it constituted cruel and unusual punishment for a juvenile under the age of 18 at the time of the non-homicide offense to be sentenced to life without parole. Pursuant to its traditional Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, the court sought to understand the meaning of cruel and unusual punishment by looking at what it calls evolving standards of decency. These standards are found by looking at state, federal, and international jurisdictions to see how they're handling a particular issue. To identify the content of current standards of decency, the majority relied on empirical data, which according to the court demonstrated that only 11 state jurisdictions apply life sentences without parole to juvenile offenders. Justice Roberts wrote only for himself. He concurred in the judgment. He agreed that under the particular facts of the case, Graham could not be sentenced to life without parole. He agreed that the Eighth Amendment calls for proportionality review of non-capital sentences, but he argued for a case-by-case approach rather than the categorical rule adopted by the majority. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Scalia joined and Justice Alito joined in part. The dissent disagreed with the majority's empirical analysis, but the disagreement is about a much more fundamental issue. The issue has to do with whether the Eighth Amendment has anything at all to say about the constitutionality of individual sentences. Thomas and Scalia argue that the Supreme Court's entire death is different and proportionality jurisprudence misunderstands the thrust of the Eighth Amendment. As a historical matter, they argue, the Eighth Amendment was about cruel and unusual methods of punishment. As such, it has nothing at all to say about the question of whether the punishment is proportional to the crime. For similar reasons, Thomas and Scalia reject the search for, quote, evolving standards of decency in Eighth Amendment jurisprudence. They argue it is illegitimate to interpret the Eighth Amendment to have a meaning that is always changing. Now, let me make a couple of very quick summary points about what Graham versus Florida does and doesn't mean. First of all, the holding disallows a sentence of life without parole for juvenile offenders who commit non-homicide crimes, but it doesn't foreclose a very, very, very long term without parole, which could almost be like a life sentence. Secondly, the majority specifically held that a state need never actually parole the juvenile offender. The holding merely requires that there be a meaningful opportunity for parole. On the other hand, the case does invite new arguments that will undoubtedly lead to more litigation. Let me just suggest two. The first kind of argument is that juvenile offenders might now try to argue for other categorical rules that preclude certain kinds of punishments as applied to them. And secondly, other categories of defendants that have been treated specially by the court's death penalty jurisprudence, for example, the mentally ill or the retarded, might try to argue that they too should be categorically excluded from extreme sentences, such as life in prison without parole. In sum, both Graham versus Florida and Burgess versus Tompkins are important cases that have either rewritten or redirected very important areas of criminal procedure jurisprudence, and we'll have to see where we go from there.
Okay, so I will talk quickly about a couple different First Amendment cases from this term, United States versus Stevens and then Citizens United. So first, United States versus Stevens. This was a case about a federal law that Congress passed prohibiting depictions of animal cruelty, where that was defined as animals being maimed, mutilated, tortured, wounded, or killed. And the legislative history suggests that this law came about in response to a phenomenon known as crush videos, which were videos depicting the crushing of small animals, supposedly catering to some sort of sexual fetish. Okay, so gross, right? This is the issue that Congress is trying to deal with this law. So no depictions of animals being maimed, mutilated, tortured, wounded, or killed. Now, we think from legislative history this was to deal with crush videos. Defendant Stevens in this case actually is prosecuted for a dogfighting video, okay? So he challenges the law on First Amendment grounds, and the Supreme Court in an 8-1 decision, which Professor Howard already told us, Alito is the dissenting justice here, but 8-1, they hold that this law is unconstitutional because it's overbroad. Now, this means that the law reaches speech that under the First Amendment should be protected, should not be criminalized, right? And it's not surprising that the court comes to the decision that the law is overbroad, because it totally was, all right? As became clear in oral argument, where the justices bring up questions about, would this cover depictions of, say, bullfighting? Would this cover depictions of, say, hunting? And although the law did have a built-in exception for depictions of animal cruelty that had value to it, the court saw this as not enough of a way of addressing the court's concerns about valuable types of speech, protected types of speech that might be reached by this law. First of all, they said this law leaves it up to courts to determine what has serious value and what doesn't. That might be problematic in and of itself. And even beyond that, there might be depictions of animal cruelty that we don't think have serious value, but we still think are protected by the First Amendment. And for these reasons, we think the law is overbroad. Now, actually, that's not all that surprising. The law was totally overbroad. The surprising and interesting thing about this case is what the court said along the way about how it does First Amendment jurisprudence. What it said was kind of a shock for those of us who watch what the court has done with First Amendment jurisprudence up to this point. The court was essentially asked to create an unprotected category of animal cruelty speech, and the court has recognized some other unprotected categories of speech, such as child pornography, obscenity, incitement. And the court declined the invitation to make an unprotected category of animal cruelty speech, and in doing so said, essentially, the government wants us to weigh the costs of this type of speech against its benefits and come to a conclusion that the costs outweigh the benefits, therefore this category of speech is unprotected. That's not how we do things. We don't weigh the costs and benefits of speech. The First Amendment has already done that measuring for us. Now, that sounds all well and good, except what the court has done in the past in making unprotected categories of speech is precisely weighing the costs and the benefits of the speech, weighing the value of the speech versus the harms that the speech might bring about. So they have to work really hard in the case to distinguish what they did in child pornography, where they said the harms of the creation of the speech to the child victims far outweigh the value of the speech in our culture, or obscenity for that matter. So the case is interesting not so much for the holding, but for how it seems as though the Robert Court understands it's going to do First Amendment in the future. Now, there's no guarantee that we'll see the court come back to this explanation of what it does. It could end up being an inconvenient piece of dicta that we never hear again. But we actually have a couple cases coming down the pike this term where the court is taking cases that are about essentially offensive speech, so picketing of funerals and violent video games and their sale to minors, where it seems as though unless the court were going to be talking about values and harms, it would have left the lower court decisions in place, because those lower court decisions struck down laws, struck down judgments on First Amendment principles, right? On principles that sound consistent with what the court has said in Stevens. So it remains to be seen whether Stevens is going to be just a blip or some new statement of how the court's going to do First Amendment, and if so, how exactly are they going to do it? So for that, we have to stay tuned. But Stevens was not the biggest First Amendment case of the term. There were a lot of First Amendment cases this term, but only one of them occasioned an intergovernmental throwdown at the State of the Union. Only one of them was called out by the President of the United States in the State of the Union address. Only one of them occasioned a justice of the Supreme Court of the United States shaking his head and muttering under his breath at the President of the United States at the State of the Union, therefore making Justice Alito an overnight YouTube celebrity. Only one case did all this, and that is Citizens United. Citizens United. You have to understand a few background principles to get into what this case is about. So the first thing you have to understand is that this is a campaign finance case, and that makes it a First Amendment case. And the reason is that the court has held for a long time, since 1978, that expenditure of money in the campaign context amounts to speech. And you can see why this might be the case, because in this day and age, instead of standing out on your street corner and handing out pamphlets saying vote for so-and-so, you might decide, I would rather send a donation to my preferred candidate, and he can put that donation with a bunch of other donations and buy some speech that will reach more people than my pamphlets would reach. So it's predicated on the idea that in the campaign finance, in the campaign context, most money that goes to campaigns and that is expended by campaigns is going to speech, is buying speech, is the paying the salaries of people who give speech out, you know, who make speech for the candidates, that really in this particular context, money is about speech. The other thing you need to understand is that doesn't give us free rein. That doesn't mean that there are no limitations that can be put on campaign finance. So the court has recognized that although money functions as speech in the campaign context, there are some concerns about having a lot of money in our electoral system. And primarily those are concerns about corruption. Having a lot of money in the system makes people worried about corruption. So Congress has some leeway to regulate campaign finance. Now another thing you need to understand is every time that Congress regulates campaign finance, money finds its way around the regulations. So just as water and perhaps other things always roll downhill, so money will find its way into the political process. And every time that Congress stops up one loophole, the money finds another one and goes through it. And this case is about a particular loophole that Congress had tried to block during its last big campaign finance law, which was the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, otherwise known as the McCain-Feingold Act of 2002. So this particular provision said this. It said corporations can't spend their general treasury funds, so the money they make by virtue of being corporations, they can't spend those funds on electioneering communications. And electioneering communications meant pretty much anything that mentions a candidate by name. Okay? So corporations can't spend general funds on electioneering communications 30 days before a primary election, 60 days before a general election. And Congress felt on pretty safe ground passing this law because of a previous Supreme Court case, which was Austin from 1990. Austin dealt with a state law that said kind of similarly, corporations can't spend general funds to help support or oppose a candidate in an election. And the Supreme Court had heard a challenge to this law. And in that challenge, they had said, okay, well, money is speech in the campaign finance context, and corporations do have speech rights. Okay, corporations do have speech rights, the court said in that case, as it had said in previous cases. But when it comes to corporations spending money to promote or try to defeat a candidate, here we think the balancing gets a little tricky. So essentially, the court applied strict scrutiny to this law and upheld it. It said, the state has a compelling interest in preventing the money that corporations amass by virtue of being corporations, from preventing that money from coming into the political system to try to elect or defeat candidates. And the concern, the governmental concern, was one about distortion. Corporations get their money not by virtue of popular support for their views, but popular consumer support for their products or services. And allowing them to put money into this political process distorts the process, right? Their money is not a representation of support for their political views. So the court said, this law is fine. It passes strict scrutiny. If you know strict scrutiny, you know that's a rare outcome. But this law passed strict scrutiny. And when the court heard a challenge to the particular law at issue here, right, this part of the McCain-Feingold law, in the McConnell case, heard a facial challenge to this part of the law, the court upheld it in 2003. Okay? So we've got Austin and we've got McConnell. Along comes Citizens United. This is a group, it's a corporation, it's a for-profit corporation, and they decide to make a gem of film called Hillary the Movie. It's a feature-length documentary raising questions about Hillary Clinton, suggesting maybe she wouldn't make a great president of the United States. As it happens, this was kind of an unwarranted precaution for Citizens United to take. Apparently, the populace didn't need Hillary the Movie to not elect Hillary president of the United States. But nevertheless, they were very concerned about this potential outcome, and so they made a movie about it. And what Citizens United is arguing is, our movie should not count as an electioneering communication. Right? It's a feature-length movie. This is not a political ad. This is a work of art. Right? And the commercials advertising it as well should not count as electioneering communications. So they're not trying to strike down this whole system. They just want an exception from it, right? They want an as-applied exception to this part of the law, right? So they lose in the district court. Because of the way that the law is structured, they then get to go to the Supreme Court. In the first round, this is what they're arguing, right? We deserve an exception to this law. And the court comes back to them, not with an opinion, but with an order for further briefing and re-argument. And the question they want the parties to brief and argue about is whether it's time to consider whether Austin and this part of the law that was considered in McConnell, this part of McConnell, should be overruled, right? So round two happens last September. The parties are arguing about this law, the constitutionality of the law. And eventually we have an opinion, which Professor Howard has already told us, it's a 5-4 decision, the majority written by Justice Kennedy, which says this part of the law is unconstitutional, strikes down the electioneering communication ban as unconstitutional, and to that extent overrules Austin and overrules this part of McConnell. Right, so the court overruling some of its own decisions. Now, let's talk very briefly about three different ways in which this could be significant. In one way, I think it's not, and the other two, I think it is. So doctrinally, I think Citizens United is not that significant a case, right? The primary propositions in Citizens United, the major moves that the court uses, well established in the case law before this case, right? Money is speech, very well established proposition. Corporations have speech rights, very well established proposition. The court is not making new law in this case on either of those points. The only thing that is different about this case is that they redid the balancing they did in Austin and found that the law failed strict scrutiny, as most laws do. The law in Austin was the only case up to this point. They happened to have decided uphold another one this term against strict scrutiny, but for years and years, Austin was the only law, First Amendment law, that had withstood strict scrutiny. So you could say Austin was the outlier here. And the only thing that changed doctrinally was their redoing the balance between the corporation's speech rights on one side and the governmental interest on the other. So doctrinally, not that interesting. Institutionally, very interesting, right? For one thing, this claim about wanting to challenge the law facially is a claim that Citizens United had abandoned earlier in the litigation. The parties had agreed to dismiss that claim, right? And the court revived it for them and asked them to rebrief it. Also, court has rules of constitutional avoidance. If we can avoid a constitutional question, resolve a case on a narrower ground, we're going to do that. There were other ways to resolve this case. The court didn't take them. It went for the constitutional question. It wanted the constitutional question. Finally, stare decisis, right? To the extent that the court should respect its precedents, this case overruled two, one 20 years old, one 7 years old. Now, different justices have different views of stare decisis, but we can't say that all the justices in the majority think nothing of stare decisis. This, they all decided, was a case where it was worth it to overrule two precedents that were directly on point. So institutionally, if we're talking about the court as an institution, this is a very interesting decision, right? This doesn't look like balls and strikes. This looks like Calvin Ball, right? So institutionally, it's very interesting. Now, I don't think that's why everyone was so upset, right? I've seen polls that suggest that 80% of the U.S. population thinks that this was a bad decision. I can't believe that 80% of people know about this decision, so I don't necessarily trust that poll. But there was a fair amount of popular outrage at it, and I think that's because of the third component, the policy significance of this. And the fact is that people get very concerned with the idea that corporations could spend unlimited amounts of their general treasury funds to try to help defeat or elect a candidate in an election. We get very nervous about that, and people think that that's a bad thing. Now, what the ramifications of this are actually going to be, it remains to be seen a little bit. So there are certainly corporations like Citizens United that were formed because of their political views, right? This is a group formed to advance a certain political position. They will certainly take advantage of this law. But when we talk about corporate money, a lot of people are concerned about other types of corporations, right? Corporations that are big businesses like Exxon, like, you know, McDonald's, and whether these people are going to start getting involved in the political process. But there are some reasons to think maybe they won't, right? Because a lot of these groups have access to the political process already through a much subtler means, such as lobbying, where you can actually get in touch with a lot of different people on a lot of different sides of things. And they might not want to, say, defeat so-and-so at the polls, because if so-and-so gets elected, they're going to want to try to work with that person, right, and convince them of their views. So it remains to be seen, actually, how this will play out. But I think if people were upset, it's because of the policy ramifications, and we'll have to leave to other people in another time the extent to which the court should be responsive to those sorts of concerns. Now, looking forward, this case also raises some legal questions. So if this principle is that corporations' speech rights are so compelling that this type of ban is unconstitutional, then there are other parts of the law that might fall to the same result. So foreign corporations have always been banned from playing any part in the political process. What's to distinguish them from other corporations? So the status of foreign corporations that have a presence in the U.S. is an open question after this case. Another one, this case doesn't mean that corporations can contribute directly to candidates' campaigns. There's been a flat ban on those types of direct contributions for a long time. But what the reasoning of this case does to that is also an open question. So looking forward, we'll probably see, and incidentally also, this suggests that other parts of the McCain-Feingold law that were upheld in McConnell could also fall. It's pretty clear that this court doesn't like the McConnell decision and that they're willing to do something about that. So in the future, we might see a lot more campaign finance. This might be only the beginning. Thanks.
So it's up to me to wrap up this evening by talking about the least sexy cases of the term, the business cases. Actually, a very interesting year for business cases. Not a lot of huge business cases. A couple that grabbed national attention, or at least one in particular that grabbed national attention. But I think a lot to learn from the business cases that came up this year, even if they weren't even if a lot of them weren't blockbusters. Hard to describe this court as pro or anti-business. If you were going to, you probably would use cases like Citizens United instead of the more traditional business cases. Rather, this term, the court looked anti-regulation in a lot of ways. The most interesting case, or the one that grabbed the most headlines, Skilling versus United States, was one of the many cases that have been spawned by that lovely creature Enron and its devolution. I love Skilling for a lot of reasons. I like to say the word Skilling for one thing. But mostly I like Skilling because it confounds attempts to classify the court or the members of the court as either liberal or conservative. Skilling is a case that holds that honest services fraud is not a valid theory under the federal wire fraud statute. It was written, Skilling was the CEO of Enron. The case was written by Justice Ginsburg, the defender of corporate CEOs everywhere, who was joined by Justice Alito, the by far the most conservative member of the court, and Justice Kennedy, the most powerful member of the court, was joined in a concurrence, adopting a theory that was rejected by the majority. So. None of the sort of dominant narratives of the court hold up in Skilling, although I'm not sure that it signals the end of that kind of speculation, nor should it. So Skilling was convicted of a whole bunch of stuff, but among that, among those things, in the fallout from Enron, he was convicted of federal wire fraud. It's kind of an odd thing for me to get convicted of. You could see securities fraud and lots of other things, but wire fraud. And the theory behind the wire fraud conviction was that in receiving his salary and the other benefits that he got from being an employee of Enron, he was obligated to disclose to the corporation and its shareholders Enron's financial position. And as Enron's financial position worsened and he failed to disclose that worsening position, in accepting his salary and benefits, he committed fraud against Enron. And the corporation at the shareholders. This theory, the honest services theory, was not originally part of the federal mail and wire fraud statutes. The federal mail and wire fraud statutes are incredibly broad in some ways. They outlaw the use of the mail or the wires in furtherance of a scheme or artifice to defraud. They don't actually require that the defendant used the mail or the wires. For instance, if the defendant gets someone else to mail them a check as part of a scheme or artifice to defraud, that violates the federal mail fraud statute. So they're incredibly broad in some ways, but they've always been limited to schemes to defraud. Over time, there were questions about whether or not a scheme to defraud included a failure to disclose some piece of information that would be material to one's employer or the public. And there were a series of court of appeals cases since the 40s that embraced the concept of honest services fraud, the idea that in accepting one's salary, one had an obligation to provide honest services and disclose these kinds of things. Most of those cases had to do with bribery or kickbacks. So officials who would receive bribes and then in exchange for those bribes would engage in some kind of conduct that was inconsistent with their duty to their employers or to the public could be charged under the mail and wire fraud statutes. It's not the bribe itself that's the fraud. It's the failure to disclose and the participation in the scheme and the failure to disclose one's participation in the scheme. Bribery is bribery, not fraud. But fraud itself can occur by omission. That's no problem. The Supreme Court rejected those cases and that approach in a case called McNally, decided in 1987, in which it held that the mail fraud statute didn't extend to honest services fraud. Congress disagreed. In 1988, Congress adopted Section 1346, which modified the definition of scheme or artifice to defraud to include a scheme or artifice to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services. All right, pretty straightforward reversal of McNally, and we go forward. Skilling gets convicted under this theory that he took his salary. Now, there's a part of the problem is that the Court of Appeals cases prior to McNally looked like they could be quite a bit broader. McNally limits it to bribes, and Congress really re-extends it. What's interesting is the approach that the court took in writing. Justice Ginsburg actually held that 1341 and 1343, the wire and mail fraud statutes, or rather the mail and wire fraud statutes, would be unconstitutionally vague if the statute were held to include this broader theory of honest services fraud. That the only way to save the statutes from being unconstitutionally vague would be to limit application of the statutes to cases involving bribery and kickbacks. Basically, a reassertion of the court's statutory interpretation in McNally. And they combined that holding with the rule of lenity, the rule of lenity in federal criminal cases being that ambiguity should be resolved in favor of defendants, to hold that the statute does not reach the kind of honest services fraud that Schilling was accused of engaging in. But I have to wonder whether or not the case is really one about vagueness. The court spent practically no time talking about how vague the statute was. Rather, the decision talks a lot about the cases leading up to McNally and McNally itself, but not necessarily about the vagueness of allowing the statute to reach this kind of violation of fiduciary duty. The concurrence, which was written by Justice Scalia, who's really quite strong on these matters, tends to be pretty strong formalist on matters of criminal interpretation and criminal law, he spends a lot of time on vagueness and attacks the majority holding, basically argues that the majority is correct, except for the statute can't be saved at all. The majority says, we're going to save the statute by saying that it's limited to cases of bribery or kickbacks. Scalia says it's hopelessly vague regardless, the whole statute has to go. When you consider how broad the mail and wire fraud statutes are already, and the degree to which we use concepts like fiduciary duty in other areas of the law, it seems a little bit odd to suggest that an obligation of fiduciary duty would be so vague that its violation couldn't possibly be, couldn't result in criminal sanction. Nor, of course, did the pre-McNally cases focus on vagueness either. They all tended to focus on how broad the statute's application would be with regard to either, if it was subject to either interpretation. So it seems to me that the court is actually a little bit more concerned about overly broad or statutes that it thinks are going to reach an incredibly broad range of conduct as opposed to statutes that are about, or statutes that might be vague. The court actually took a sort of similar moves in a couple of other cases this year, which is one of the reasons why I think that this is a pretty reasonable approach. And the concern over the criminalization or semi-criminalization of an incredibly broad range of conduct. So in Hemi Group versus the City of New York, Hemi Group was a company, a New Mexico company, I believe, that sold cigarettes. They shipped a whole bunch of cigarettes to folks who lived in the City of New York. The Jenkins Act requires that the folks who do that file reports with the state to which they're shipping the cigarettes, because cigarettes are, I don't know how many of you smoke, subject to a substantial amount of tax. States are interested in collecting those taxes, and so the Jenkins Act requires, a federal statute, requires that those who ship cigarettes into states have to file these reports with the state to allow the state to collect the tax. The City of New York, of course, is not the state of New York. The City of New York has its own set of taxes that they want to collect. They didn't collect those taxes, in part because Hemi didn't file the reports. The City of New York decides to sue Hemi for violation of the racketeering statute. The racketeering statute is an incredibly broad statute, basically engaging in two or more predicate acts in a series or as part of a scheme can make one liable for racketeering, which is a major crime, but also opens one up to treble damages. So the City of New York is looking for treble damages by applying the racketeering statute, and the Supreme Court said no. Even assuming that failure to file a Jenkins Act report would be a predicate act for the RICO statute, and I think that the court thought that was debatable, the failure to pay the tax was not caused by the failure to file the report. That is, the Supreme Court wants a very direct relationship between the predicate act and the application of the racketeering statute. Why? I think for reasons similar to its concern about criminalizing violations of fiduciary duty in Skilling, just that there's a huge amount of conduct that could potentially fall underneath the statute, either criminalizing it or subjecting it to treble damages will get the courts involved in trying to police this conduct that may be policed in some other ways. And then finally, in Morrison versus National Australia Bank, the court addressed the extraterritorial application of the securities law and again came up with a limiting understanding of how the securities law should be interpreted. Morrison involved so-called 3F securities claims by foreign investors for securities purchased on a foreign exchange by a foreign issuer. The U.S. connection here was that the information, the allegedly fraudulent information, was generated in Florida, as is a lot of allegedly fraudulent information, I think. The court was pretty strict. No extraterritorial application of the of federal securities law. Only transactions and securities listed on domestic exchanges and domestic transactions and other securities can be the subject of a suit under Section 10B, the securities fraud provision. So I think throughout you see the court taking a limiting approach to these statutes which are amenable to incredibly broad application, but the court is trying to cut that off and drive individuals towards more specific remedies. So a more specific remedy under the Jenkins Act, or perhaps more specific remedies under the Securities Act. I think I'm just gonna leave it at that.